And we're holding on Nun Zion, Umud Beis, a little bit above the middle of the wide lines. The line begins. We're in the middle of talking, we're in the middle of the Agadta of the Churban. We talked about how Yerushalayim was destroyed, Tur Malka and Beitar. And now the Gemara has been telling us various other apparently miscellaneous things that refer to one or the other of these times and various incidents that happened at that time. So the Gemara says, Amar of Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, V'itamer Rab Ami, V'ami Lav Masnisa Tana. Rab Yehuda says in the name of Shmuel, others say Rab Ami said it, others say we learn in a Braisa. Maisa B'dalad Meis Yolodim B'Yolodis Shenishbul Akolim. It happened once that 400 boys and girls, young men and boys and girls, young men and women, however you want to learn it exactly, had been taken prisoner for Kolon for humiliating purposes, meaning the boys they wanted to use, the boys the Romans were going to use for Mishkav Zohar, and the girls they were going to take as concubines. Hugishu ba'atzman lamahen bespachin, they realized what they're being taken for. On the boat there, on the ship, they realize what they're being taken for. They're not stam being taken captives to be sold like many other Jews at that time. They're being taken for this purpose. Omru, so they asked, if we drown in the sea, will we come to Chaya on Maba? So their question can be, and Marsha explains their question was, we know that people who die outside Eretz Yisrael have Gilgul Mechilos. They're going to roll through tunnels to get to Eretz Yisrael when it comes to the time for Tchias HaMesim. So the question would be then whether that's going to happen if they fall into the sea and drown. And a different explanation is they're asking if they commit suicide. Usually a person who commits suicide loses their place in Olam Haba, but is this case different? The greatest among them, or the eldest among these boys and girls, Darshin, based on a pasuk, Omar Hashem mi Boshan Oshiv. Hashem says, "I will return. I will bring back from Boshan Oshiv mi Mitzulos Yom. I'll bring back from the depths of the sea." And so he explained, "Mi Boshan Oshiv means mi Bein Shinei Aryeh. It means from even between the teeth of the lions." Which at that time, by the way, the same way as you had these 400 boys and girls were being taken to Rome for immoral purposes, at the same time, many other Jews who had been captured by the Romans were being taken and used in the arenas and places like the Colosseum or whatever for fighting against wild animals, which the Romans liked those kinds of spectacles. So that may be why this boy Darshan that part as well. So even those who are between the teeth of the lions, even those who are killed in these arenas fighting against the wild animals, yes, Hashem says, I will bring them back and they will have Tchias HaMesim. And Oshim Mitzulos Yom, Elo Shatovim Bayam, and I will bring back from the depths of the sea, refers to those who drown in the sea. So yes, in other words, if we drown in the sea, we will have Tchias HaMesim. Even Shoshamu Yolodis Kach, when the girls heard this, Koftzu Kulan Menoflo L'Seich HaYam, all of them jumped and fell into the sea. Nosi Yolodim Kavachom of Atzman. So then that caused the boys. Now, by the way, Tosfos brings up a point, though, that the question still is, even we're saying they're going to have Tchias HaMesim based on that pasuk, but how are they allowed to commit suicide? And so Tosfos brings a couple of explanations. Number one, they're afraid of Yisurim. The Romans might torture them. So some Mephoshim explain, in other words, it means since we find Tosfos brings from a Gemara that torture is worse than death in a way, so therefore it means that would give them legitimate reason to avoid, in order to avoid torture, they might be allowed to do that. Another point is the torture would be more that they're going to be forced to violate mitzvahs of Yiddishkeit, and for that there's reason for them to be able to get out of it like this. In fact, Tosfos says they might only torture them, not kill them, at least if the torture would eventually be that they'll die from it, then maybe they can't do anything about it and they have to leave it up to Hashem. But if the point is they're going to torture them to force them to violate mitzvahs, as in this case, they're going to be using them for their immoral purposes, which is usur, so then there would be a legitimate reason for them to do that. Anyway, Nosu Yolodim Kavachomer Ba'atzman, the boys now started making a Kavachomer. But Omru, they thought to themselves, Ma Halolu, Madach the girls should Dauken Lakach, where it's normal for them to be, I mean, as much as not to be used by the Romans, of course, but after all, Tashmish is normally what's done with girls. And yet, kach, and they did like that, they jumped into the water. We boys, where it's not even an, where it's a completely unnatural thing for us to be used for Mishkav Zohar like that. Allah is kama kama, how much more so that we should also go on Mesiras Nefesh for it. So they also jumped into they also jumped into the sea. On such boys and girls, the Pasuk says, for your sake, we're killed all day long. We're considered like sheep that are available for the slaughter. So meaning, in other words, the way that these children went and went on Mesiras Nefesh and all of them died, then that's represented in the with Beruah HaKodesh in that Pasuk, that that this kind of thing is that this kind of thing is going to happen. So nechshavnu, Marsha explains, in other words, like they consider it in their own eyes that they should be katzon tivcha and not worry about the fact how could we kill ourselves, is they want to avoid that they should be used for avenus. This and a number of the other stories that we have here in the Gemara are mentioned in one or another of the kinos that we say on Tisha B'Av day. There's one of the kinnas towards the end of it mentions this story where they're being brought, the Medrash adds the details, they were being brought in three ships. So it mentions that over there. The Gemara continues, Rav Yehuda Omer, Zu Isha V'Shiva Baner. Rav Yehuda says a different reference of that pasuk, Ki Alecha Haragnu Kol Hayom, refers to the story of a woman and her seven sons. Now here the Gemara is going to tell it in connection with the Churban. Famously, we know it's also told over a very similar story in connection with Hanukkah during in the times of Antiochus. So the story may have happened more than once. What the woman's name was also, here the Gemara doesn't even name her. Some Midrashim called her Miriam, one Midrash calls her Miriam, another one Miriam Bas Nachtam, another one calls her Hannah, which is how we best know it. Anyway, so they were also killed our Kiddush Hashem. And now the Gemara is going to talk about the seven children. Marsha explains each of them was Moser Nefesh and was killed on a different day of the week. So therefore he says that's what the Ki Alecha Haragnu Kol Hayom. Every single day there's something where Jews are being, where a different every day of the week there's Jews being killed Al Kiddush Hashem, and each one is going to have an appropriate pasuk to that has to do with that day. So they brought the oldest son in front of the emperor to force him to worship Avodah Zarah. Omer like plach la'avodas kechavim. They tell him worship Avodah Zarah. Omer lehu, he says no. Kosev b'Torah anochi Hashem elokecha. It says in the Torah, I am Hashem your God, and that means no Avodah Zarah. So they took him out and executed. Then they brought the second child. You should not have any other gods in my presence. They brought the third one. Don't worship any other gods. So they took him and killed him. They brought the fourth child. I skipped a little bit over here. The first one was Anochi Hashem Elokecha. The second one is Lo Yiyah Lecha Elokim Acherim. The third one is Kosev HaTorah Zeveach Lelokim Yochrom. Anyone who sacrifices or does any other kind of avodah to other gods will be destroyed. Apku v'katlu, they took him out and killed him. Asiru Leidoch, they brought the fourth child. Plach Laveres Kachavim. He says, Kosev HaTorah Leishashach Lelokel Acher. Don't bow to any other god. Apku v'katlu, they took him and killed him. Asiul the Idoch, they brought the fifth child. They took him and killed him. Asiul the Idoch, they brought the sixth child. You should know today and put it firmly in your mind that Hashem is the one God in heavens above and in the earth below. There's nothing else. So I'm not worshiping you, Avodah Zarah. Each of them obviously saying, therefore, I'm not worshiping you, Avodah Zarah. They took him and killed him. Then they brought the seventh child. They tell him worship of the Zara. He says that the Pasuk says, you have declared today that Hashem is your God, and Hashem has declared you today that you're his people. Meaning, we've already sworn to Hashem that we won't exchange him for another God. And Hashem in turn has sworn to us that he won't exchange us for any other nation. So the emperor says to the seventh child, and by the way, the Medrash, when it tells over the story, says that this child was very, very young. The Medrash says over there, the Chachamim afterwards calculated and found the boy was like 2.5 years old, plus a couple of days and hours. It mentions the detail over there. So the emperor in his fragorish, the cruel way, has Rachmanos on the kid. He says, Eshtilach Gushpanka, let me throw my, fine, I understand you don't want to openly bow to Avodah Zarah. I'll throw down my ring onto the ground, the goch and b'shakle, and then you bend down and pick it up. That way, at least people will say that you accepted on yourself the order of the king, meaning in other words, it'll be when you bend down to pick up the, when you bend down to pick up the ring, people will think that you bent down to worship the Avodah Zarah, and they won't look like so blatantly you're disobeying. Omalei, so the kid, again, as the Medrash says, was almost 2.5 years old. He says, Chaval aloch keser, chaval aloch keser. Woe to you, keser, woe to you, keser. Al kvoid atzmach kach. You're so concerned about your own honor. Al kvoid HaKadosh Baruch Hu, alachas kama v'kama. How much more so we should be concerned about the covet of Hashem, and not even for appearance's sake, go and pretend like we're worshiping Avodah Zarah. An interesting Musa Dikavort about that is he's telling the case of Chaval Alecha, you're so concerned about your covered, so, but you should realize no matter how much covered you have, it's never going to be enough. So why are you even bothering? Akula Miktale, they were going to take the child out to kill him. So Maharsha explains, he goes in detail how he explains each of these psukim had something to do with one of the 7 days of Maisa Bereshis. He says these seven children, each one of them was a different day from Sunday to Shabbos, and each one set an appropriate pasuk to that day of the week. So the first one, for example, on the first day, Hashem hadn't created any other beings yet than no malachim even, so there's no possibility even of thinking that there are any powers other than Hashem. Corresponding to that, he says, Anoichi Hashem Alekecha. The second day, he says, Lo Yilecha, on that day, the malachim were created. People might think mistakenly that the malachim are co-creators or co-gods with Hashem, and therefore, Lo Yilecha stresses that not. And he goes through how each of these psukim has a slightly different girsa, which is around the fifth and the sixth. But anyway, the point is he explains that each one of them is appropriate to that day of the week. The last one, as Hashem HaMautayim, represents after everything is created. But now people might mistakenly think, because you have the famous expression, Ozev Hashem HaSa'oretz, that Hashem has now abandoned the world and lets it run by himself. But no, it's Hashem HaMautayim that we have avowed and vouched for Hashem that he is our God, that he's actually watching over us. And Shabbos is in token of that. In fact, Maharsha says also when the Gemara is bringing this over here in connection with the pasuk Ki Alecha Hiragnu Kol Hayom, he explains that actually if you look earlier in that pasuk is in Kapitel Ayin Dalet, which is talking about the Churban and the Golus. You have many psukim over there actually corresponding to that. Before that, where you go through psukim upon psukim, saying how we're faithful to Hashem even in the worst conditions, and we're Moisa Nefesh, and he explains how psukim upon psukim in that kapitel refer and hint to details in this story. Anyway. So Akul Miktale, so now they took this child out to kill him as well. Omrulahu ime yavuniali, the mother says, give him to me first. Inshike puta, let me kiss him a little bit. Omrulah, and she tells him, Bonai lechu imrul Avram avichem, go tell your father Avram, Atar akad to mizbeach echad, you bound only one child on the mizbeach, v'ani akad to shiva mizbechais, I bound seven children on mizbechas, I had seven children who were killed, our Kiddush Hashem. And in a way, therefore, my Mesiris Nefesh is greater than yours. Afhi Osala Gag, the Nofla Mesa, and then after her seventh child was killed as well, she also went up to the roof and fell down and died. There's again a number of different explanations. Doesn't mean that she went up there, and then doesn't mean that she actually jumped with any. Again, you have the question, how could she commit suicide, just like Tosfos mentioned before, and you have a few different answers on that. Again, some of the answers that Tosfos gave before about the children on the ship would apply over here also. She may have known that their next thing they're going to do is arrest her and torture her and force her to worship Avodah Zarah. Or just that even maybe the fear of torture itself is a valid enough reason for her to do this. It might also be that she went up and then she fell down rather than jumping off. And it may also be, some of the Mephoshim say, that she was in such a distraught condition that, look, you know, you can't really, a person can't be responsible for what they do under those conditions. The Maharal actually says it doesn't necessarily mean that she jumped off or anything like that. It doesn't actually necessarily literally mean that she went up to a roof. Bechlal, it means she's ready at this point to die, and Hashem fulfilled what she wanted. Bechlal, the Maharal throughout this whole Agadte, he has a detailed explanation of it in his Sefer Netzach Yisrael, and he goes through, and a lot of the things that we say in these Gemaras over here, he explains more symbolically. Earlier on Omer Aleph, when we learned yesterday, for example, about Tur Malka and the enormous number of cities and the enormous number of people in it, he says it doesn't necessarily mean literally, it just means the amount of bracha that there was in Eretz Yisrael. At that time, there could have conceivably been that many cities, each with that many people, but in practice, there weren't that many. So similarly over here, he explained, doesn't actually mean she went up to the roof, just that she was so distraught, she wanted at this point to die. She has nothing more to live for, and Hashem caused that to happen. Yotza Basko v'omra, Basko came out and announced, Ema bonim smecha, the mother of the children should be happy, that she'll be happy. And Olam Abba, that she had such children who went on Mesiras Nefesh like that, even at such ages, and she'll be rejoiced, and much as she was distraught in Olam Hazeh over it, she'll be happy with them in Olam Abba. So that's another thing of Ki Alecha Hiragnu Kalayun. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi says another meaning of that pasuk, Zum Mila Shenitna Bishmini. That refers to the mitzvah of Mila, which is given to be done on the eighth day of the baby's life. And sometimes there is danger involved. Sometimes, Rachman Lotfan, a baby dies as a result of Bris Mila, and still we continue to do the mitzvah anyway. Actually, the Chassam Sofer says, I mean, you know, we see that in practice, it's very, very rare that children die from complications of Bris Mila. He says, yeah, that's because the mitzvah protects us. But if it hadn't been for that, yes, it would be a lot higher. But we go on Mesiras Nefesh and we do it anyway. Reb Shimon Lakish Amar Eivu Tamer Chachamim Shemarin Hilchas Shechita Ba'atzman. Reb Lakish says that the Ki Alecha Ragnu Kalayim refers to Tamer Chachamim who demonstrate Hilchas Shechita on themselves. So they, the Amar Rava Kol Mili Lechzi Inish Benafshe. Rava says a person can demonstrate any mitzvah on himself by Mishchita V'Davar Acha, with the exception of Shechita, because he might accidentally cut his throat. And Davar Acha, which is Tzaras, that a person shouldn't show saras on himself, because then it might actually happen. Al tiktach pel asot. So Rashi says, as far as the shechita, that he might literally, the knife might slip and he cuts his throat. Marsha understands not even that. It's that plus the tzaras is more al tiftach pel asotin. A person opens up his mouth to the sotin, that itself can cause bad things to happen. So Bakashtras, Marsha may be saying not even he actually uses the actual knife itself, just like he uses his finger on his throat or whatever, but it's still a matter of al tiftach pel asotin. And still, Tamar Chachamim do it anyway, showing that they're fulfilling the pasuk Ki Alecha Hiragnu Kalayim. They're willing to take that risk in order to teach Torah more fully. Rav Nachum Yitzchok Amar, Eilu Tamar Chachamim Shemimisin Atzman Al Divrei Torah. Rav Nachum Yitzchok says that the pasuk Ki Alecha Hiragnu Kalayim refers to Tamar Chachamim who kill themselves over Divrei Torah. Kidrav Shimon Lakish, like the way Rosh Lakish explains it, Dramarav Shimon Lakish, Ein Divrei Torah Miskaimin Elo B'Mishem Memes Atzmei Aleihem. Words of Torah are preserved only by somebody who kills himself over them, meaning, in other words, a person who's willing to forego a lot of the comforts in life, like you have in Pirkei Avos, Pas Melech Toichel, or Mayim Mesura Tishta, and so forth. Shenema Zoysa Torah Odom Ki Yomus Ba'oyel, as the Pasuk says, this is the Torah when a man dies in a tent, So in context, of course, talking about the halachas of Truma v'Tahara, but we darshin from it that, in other words, that the how this is the Torah. How does a person achieve the Torah when he's willing to die and then kill his taivus in the tents of Torah? So therefore, so the pasuk ki halacha hiragnu kol hayom is referring to that to that kind of thing as well. That a person is willing to kill his taivus and his yetzahara for the sake of learning. Getting back now to the story of the people who were killed in Beitar, Amar Rabbi Baba Chana, Amar Rabbi Yechanan, Arboim Sok, Tzutze Tfilin Nimtzu Baroshe Haruge Beitar. Altogether, 40 stuff of Tfilin boxes were found on the heads of the people who were killed at Beitar. So in other words, there were millions, hundreds of thousands, or even millions of Jews. So now we're saying that afterwards, the bodies, the Romans, found on their heads, people used to wear tefillin all day, they found 40 saw, just of the tefillin boxes alone, filled up 40 saw. Again, can mean literal, although the Maharal has an explanation that it means symbolically tefillin are the strength of the Jewish people. Beito, we said before, is Keren Yisrael, is the strength of the Jewish people. And there, and he explains why Dafka 40 saw. Rabbi Yana Bibishmol says it wasn't 40 saw, it was altogether, it filled up three baskets of 40 saw each. And in a braisa we learn that it was arranged differently. Our boim corpus shall shalosh sin, 40 baskets each of 3 saw. So both Rabbi Yana and Rabbi Shmuel and the braisa are both agreeing there were 120 saw. They're just saying how were they put into baskets, in 40 saw baskets or in three saw baskets. But the Gemara says, "V'loy pligi." They're not actually arguing. Hader Reisha, Hader Dra. One is talking about the Tefillin Shal Roish, the other the Tefillin Shal Yad. So Rashi points out the Tefillin Shal Roish are bigger because, after all, you have to have 4 batim in each one. Nowadays, we have our Tefillin Shal Roish and Tefillin Shal Yad are basically the same size, but they don't really have to be that way. Really, especially in those times, they used to have much smaller tefillin, as they found in archaeological digs and such like. So they have to make the compartments of the shal rosh large enough to be able to fit the parashiyos, as opposed to the shal yad, where all of them go in one compartment. It doesn't have to be made quite that large. So he explains it's not 1 to 4, even though the shal rosh has 4 compartments, because the fact is the fact is that the one bias of the altogether, actually, he says that the one compartment of the shal yad is a little bit larger than any of the individual compartments of the shal rosh. So therefore, it's not a 1 to 4 ratio. But nevertheless, as the Gemara is saying over here, it is a 1 to 3 ratio, because the fact is you have to have separation between the batim in the shal rosh. So in other words, when we started by saying, when Rabbi Baba Chana said that they found 40 sov ktsutzei tefillin, refers to the shal yads. When we're saying they found 120 saw, that means the shal roshes. So why are we saying that the 40 saw in that case were found beroshe haruge beter on their heads? In that case, then apparently Rabbi Baba Chana is referring to the armed tefillin. So there's a few answers. One of them being that since they were busy carrying weapons with their arm, they didn't want to wear tefillin on that. So therefore, they would take off the tefillin temporarily from there and put it on their head. There is, after all, room on the head. In halacha, it says there's room to put two tefillin, one next to the other. Another answer is that Roshe over here actually means the leaders as opposed to the common people. And then there's different explanations. Maharam Shif talks about that, after all, you put on the shal yad first and you take off the shal rosh last. And that would be another reason, or the other way around. You put on the shal yad first and you take it off last. Therefore, you have much more time when you're wearing the shal yad. And therefore, there's a higher, therefore, the for that reason, the shal yad that they found on their bodies weighed more than the shal roshes. So here the explanation would be the other way around then. The shal yads weigh more in aggregate and the shal roshes less, because there were more people that were found with shal yads on than shal roshes. The Gemara continues, Omer Abasi, Arbor Kabin Moyach Nimtzu al Evan Achas. At one point, they found four kabim of brains of Jews who had been killed and smashed against the rock, all on one rock. Ula Amatisha's kabin, Ula says it wasn't 4 kabin, it was 9 kabin. So on the surface, we're talking about at the time of the Churban Bayis Rishon, and this was the Bavliim who did it, as the Gemara is going to bring the Pasuk over here from Tilim that refers to the Babylonians doing this. On the other hand, the Maharal again explains that it's a continuation of the thing about Beter, and he explains the symbolism, since we were just talking about Tefillin, and the Tefillin go on the brain, and therefore we're saying that this is what happened. Omer of Kahanavi, Tema Shila Bar Mori, Maikra, where is a Pasuk that we see that such things happen? In Kapitel Kuf Lamed Zayin, which is about the Churban. Bas Bavel Ashduda, you daughter of Bavel, who are eventually going to be robbed, meaning that the next empire, the Persians, are going to come and take you over and rob you of all your treasures. Ashri she shalom lachagam, happy will be the one who pays you back what you deserve. And the pasuk continues, Ashri she yoiches v'nipetzes alayich alasala, happy will be the one who takes and smashes your babies against the rock. So we see, in other words, that the Pasuk is saying the Babylonians themselves did that. They took Jewish children and smashed them against rocks. And therefore, David is saying with Ruach HaKodesh that you deserve the same thing will happen to you as well when you're next conquered. So therefore, that's we see that there were Pasuk brains lying on the rock over there where Goyim had done that. Continues the Gemara. The Pasuk says, a Pasuk in Eicha, B'nei Tzion ha'yikorim ha'msuloyim ba'poz. The precious children of Tzion who were mesuloyim with paz. Now, paz is some kind of a precious stone, or some of the mephoshim say it means an extra refined kind of gold. So what is mesuloyim? My mesuloyim bapaz. Ilema to have a machapi bapiza. Does it mean that they were covered with paz, that they wore a lot of paz jewelry, for example, and therefore the word mesuloyim would be from a word that means to smooth out, to flatten out. So in other words, like they have plates of paz on them. No, for Amid Dveir of Shila, they said in the yeshiva of Rav Shila, Tauti maskili istri piza nochus ba'alma, two measures of an istira, which is a small coin, of paz came down to the world. One came down in Rome and won the whole rest of the world. So therefore, there'd be no reason for the Pasuk to be stressing that the children of Tzion are covered with paz. Ella, no, what it means is showing Maganan as a paz b'yofyon means they would put paz to shame with their beauty. The children of Yerushalayim, the people of Yerushalayim, were so beautiful and so handsome that compared to them, paz, this precious stone or whatever it is, looked ugly. So therefore, so now the Pasuk is saying, the Pasuk continues that they were misaloyim by paz, and continues in the Pasuk, Eicha nechshavu b'mivlei cheres, they're now considered like worthless earthenware containers. So what happened is, me'ikra chashivi d'reimoi havunakti b'yonu d'gushpanka, originally, before the Churban, the important Romans, the senators and whatnot, and the nobleman would hold on to a signet ring that had an image on it, or Meshamshi Arsayhu, and when they would do Tashmish Amita, they would have that before them. We know from many different Midrashim that what a couple has in mind while they're having relations has a very powerful effect on the baby. They wanted that their babies should be strong and handsome and beautiful and whatever. So they would have these images that were on their signet rings that they would have in front of them so that they'd be thinking about those when they're having relations, and that way the children would look like those images. Mikan ve'elach, after the Churban, Maisu b'nei Yisrael v'asri v'kari t'porayu m'shamshi. After that, they would take Jewish children who, as we just said, are even more beautiful than paz, and they would tie them to the legs of their beds and then have relations. So that way, like they're using the Jews almost as like human images or human dolls or something. So one of these Jews who was in this position asks another one, ha heichaksiva. Where does it say in the Torah any such thing, that such things are going to happen? Many different, we know they have the Torah in the Torah, but where does it even hint at that there's going to be such a disgusting purpose to which they're going to be putting us Jews? Omalei, so he says, you have in the Torah in Kisavai, gam kocholi v'chomaka shalechosu v'sefer ha-Torah azois. Also, every sickness and every illness that it doesn't say in this Sefer Torah. So we're referring to this. In other words, this is not the kind of thing that would be written in the Torah, because not derech eretz to write it in the Torah. But nevertheless, the Torah is hinting to it with these words. Omar, so the first one who asked the question asks, "Kalam achikna meduchta plan? How far away am I from that point in the Torah? I haven't yet learned that pasuk. Where is it?" Omale, so the other one says ingid, not very much. Pustel paga, a daf and a half, a column and a half in the Sefer Torah. Omale, so the first one says, imatoila gabe lo itzturichilach. If I had reached that pasuk, I wouldn't have needed you. I would have realized myself that that's what the pasuk is referring to. Or another explanation for some of Roshim, as he's saying, I would have realized that, yeah, the Torah is implying that there are many different things that are not given explicitly in the Torah, but that are included in the Torah, and I would have realized this is one of those things, even if there's no explicit pasuk for this. So I would have understood. I wouldn't have even needed to ask you. Why is he saying like that? He may be saying, for example, that I understand it's very painful for you to have to talk about and to explain what this condition that we're in. If I had known, I would have done it myself, and I wouldn't have had to ask you and then trouble you like that. He may also mean, actually, you know, if only I'd learned a little more before we were taken captive, if only I'd put my time a little more into learning, then I would have already reached that point. Anyway, the Gemara continues. Amar of Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, Meshum Reb Shimon Gamliel. My dichtiv, another pasuk in Eicha, Eini Oyla Lola Nafshi Mikol Benois Im. My eye has disfigured myself more than all the daughters of my city. Mikol can also mean because of all the daughters of my city. So in other words, Yirmiyo is saying in Megillas Eicha, I'm crying so much over what happened to the daughters and to the people of my city that I've become disfigured. I became like unattractive from so much crying. So what does this refer to? There were 400 shuls in the city of Beit, in the fortified city of Beit. Every one of those shuls was so large, it had 400 malamdim in it. And each of those teachers had 400 talmidim learning in front of them. Again, the Maharal says that these numbers are more symbolic, and some of them, Mefoshim, take it more literally. The Iyun Yaakov, for example, wonders, so how does it, do we find in Halacha that a teacher is not supposed to teach more than 25 students? Does it mean maybe that because they weren't giving enough attention to Chinuch, and they're just having like that one teacher teaching to 400 students as a reason why the schus of the Tinoikos Rabbis Rabban didn't protect them? He says maybe, but Sarachim. Anyway. If an enemy would come into there, the children would pierce him with their sticks. They had sticks that they used to keep the place when they're learning, to pointers to point to where they are up to in Chumash. It can also mean the pens that they were writing with, whatever. So in other words, there were so many children over there that they, or just the children alone, could fight off any enemy that comes in. But then when the enemy became more powerful and captured them and conquered the city of Beitar, they wrapped up each of these children in their own Sifrei Torah, the Tzitzum Ba'esh, and set them on fire. In other words, at that point, even the schus of their learning and even the schus of the Sifrei Torah did not protect them. The Gemara continues, Tanan Abanan, Maiseh B'Rav Yishur Ben Chananya Sholoch L'Krach Gadol Sheberoyim. It happened once that Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya went to the great city of Rome. Omruloi, they told him, Tinik echad yesh beis asurim. There's a young boy in the jail over there, a young Jewish boy. Yefei nayim b'tov roi. He has beautiful eyes. He has a beautiful appearance. U'kvutzosef studus le'taltalim. And his hair is curled in ringlets around his face. So Poshut is physically beautiful. They may have mentioned those points because that way, in other words, there's a much greater chance that the Romans are going to want to keep him from Mishkav Zachar, like those boys that we had on the ship before. Anyway, Holach Ba'omer al Pesach Beis Asurim, Rabbi Yeshua went and stood in front of the entrance of the jail to find out what to take the measure of this trial. Omar, he starts saying the first half of the pasuk from Yeshaya, Mi nosa mamshisa Yaakov Yisrael levoizes him. Who is it that gave Yisrael to be despoiled and Yisrael to, who is it that gave Yaakov mamshisa to be despoiled, Yisrael levoizes him and Yisrael to be plundered? So he started saying that half of the pasuk. Ona oisa tinik v'omar, the child from inside the jail answered back with the second half of the pasuk. Haloi Hashem zuchatanu loy. Isn't it Hashem against whom we've sinned? V'loi over b'drach of haloich. They didn't want to go in his ways. V'loi shomu b'seirase. And they did not listen to his Torah. So on one level, in other words, Rabbi Yeshua is like almost like complaining about Hashem's justice, and the child who's suffering over there in jail is acknowledging that everything that Hashem does is fair. And there's a lot of different explanations also what Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Gemara is going to say, that Rabbi Yeshua was very impressed by this. There's a lot of different explanations. You have that. You have an explanation that Parshat it shows the child knew the halacha even at such a young age that you're not allowed to interrupt in the middle of a pasuk. You have to finish it. And there's a lot of different explanations. An interesting one that Ben Yehoyada brings is that usually you have, like we learned before, kam le b'dirab mine, and you have a related concept in halacha, ein adam loiko mashalim, a person does not get malchus and also has to have to pay money. So Rabbi Yeshua is asking with the first half of the pasuk, why is it that both were suffering physically from the Romans and they're taking all of our money? So it's like loiko mashalim. And the child answers back because there were two different levels of Aveda. There was what our ancestors were doing by not listening to Hashem, and there's what we ourselves are doing against Hashem. So therefore, yeah, double punishment is appropriate and necessary. There's a lot of different other explanations of what the back and forth was between them. Anyway, Omar, Rabbi Yeshua says, Muftechani boi shemora hirah b'Yisrael. I am certain that this child will eventually paskin halacha among the Jewish people. He said, so great, even now when he's a child, imagine what he's going to be when he grows up. Ha'avoda, I swear by the avoda of the Beis Mikdash, she'eni zoz mikan, I will not move from here, ad she'efdenu b'chomom and she'poskin olav, unless I redeem him with no matter how much money they demand for him. Omru, and they said, sure enough, lo zoz mishamat she'pdoi b'mom and habit. He didn't move from there until he redeemed him, until he ransomed him for a large amount of money. And sure enough, not long passed before he was paskining and teaching halacha among the Jewish people. Umanu, Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha, this child, this boy was Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha. Now, here Tosfos brings up the question that we had previously on Daf Mem Hei. There we said that you're not allowed to ransom people for more than they're worth, because that'll give the goyim incentives to kidnap Jews again. So why is Rabbi Yeshua not concerned about that? So here Tosfos says the Sakonis Nefoshes, although other Rishonim disagree with that. They say every time a person is captured by Goyim, he's in danger of Sakonis Nefoshes. Anyway, Tosfos says another reason is because he's such an exceptional Talmud Chacham, as he sees from this back and forth with him. So therefore, that would be an exception. You could be poed to him like that. Uli, on Daf Mem Hei, Tosfos gave a different answer. That, look, the whole point is you don't want to give goyim an incentive to kidnap Jews. Well, at the time of the Churban, they don't need any incentive. We had at the beginning of the sugya that they're killing Jews right and left. So therefore, there's no concern that now they're going to be more motivated to kidnap Jews. And then there's various other answers as well, how he could do that. There's b'chlal some discussion who this Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha is. On the face of it, it's Rabbi Shmuel, the chaver of Rabbi Akiva, who was Taka, a boy at the time of the Churban, and then eventually he grew up and became one of the great Chachamim. On the other hand, you have another Gemara that mentions Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha going into the Kodesh HaKadoshim and seeing a Malach over there, V'raisi HaKasriya, Ko Hashem Tzvokas, etc. Anyway, so there's different explanations. There may have been two Rabbi Shmuel ben Elishas. Some say they were even grandfather and grandson. On the other hand, the Maharam Shif over here says maybe this story happened long before the Churban, maybe 40 years before the Churban, when they started seeing signs of the impending Churban. Maybe at this point is when Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha was taken prisoner to Rome, and then later on he grew up and became the Kohen Gadol, Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha. So there's different possibilities. Since we're mentioning him, Amar Yehuda Amar Rab, Ma'is b'bnei b'bita shel Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha shenishbu l'shnei adonim. It happened that the son and the daughter of Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha were captured by two different goyim. L'yomim nizdavgu shnei b'makom echad. Eventually, these two goyim met up. One says, I have a slave who has no equal in the world as far as beauty, as far as handsomeness. The other one says, I have a maidservant, that there's no one as beautiful in the world as her. So they thought to themselves, let's marry them off to one another, and we'll divide the children among us. They'll be our slave and maidservant. The children that they bear will also be our slaves. And that way, we'll have beautiful children, and we'll each get half of them. So they brought them into a room. Each one sat in a different corner of the room. The boy was saying, "Ani koyin ben koyinim golem at esa shivcha." The one was saying, "I'm a koyin. I'm the descendant of koyinim golem. His father had been Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha, the koyin gadol. Esa shivcha. I should marry a shivcha." He didn't know that the girl is his sister. V'zoyse meres, and the other one was saying, "Ani koyenes bas koyinim golem and nosel eved. Should I marry an eved?" Ubochu kol alayla, and they were sitting there crying the whole night over what's going to happen. Then when dawn came and there was light in the room, in other words, up until now it was dark, so they couldn't see each other. Now they recognized one another. They fell on one another and were crying out and were crying. Go literally means like the kind of noise an animal makes, almost like they were crying bitterly until their neshamas left them. And Conan Yumia refers to them and then mourns for them with the pasuk Al Ela Ani Vechia, for these I cry, Ani Yodamayim. My eye is shedding water of tears. Marsha explains, you see, the previous pasuk mentions how the Bachura and Basulas Bas Yehuda, so that represents this Bachur and this Basula. And the Ani Boichia means this is the sister talking about her brother, and Ani Yodamayim is Yumia saying that both of my tears are crying over this boy and girl and what happened to them. Again, we have one of the kinos on Tisha B'Av day that takes as its subject and tells over poetically the story. The Gemara continues, Amar Shlokish, Maisa Be'isha Achas V'Tzofnas Bas Pniel Shema. There was a woman whose name was Tzofnas Bas Pniel. And why was she called that? Tzofnas Shah called Tzofen B'Yafia. She was called Tzofnas because everybody would look at her beauty. So Meloshin Tzefia, Meloshin looking. Bas Pniel is Bitish or Kohen Gadol Shishimish Lefnai V'Lefnim. She was the daughter of a Kohen Gadol who would serve in the innermost place in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Anyway, so she was captured at the time of the Churban, or sometime after that. The whole night, the captor, the goy who had captured her, abused her and raped her. The next day, he dressed her in seven layers of clothing, one on top of the other, and took her out to sell her as a maidservant. A very ugly person came, and he says, "Show me her beauty, I'm interested in buying her." So the seller says, "Reka, you empty person, if you want to buy her, go ahead and buy her. There's nobody like her beauty in the entire world. So why are you even bothering? You shouldn't even need to look. And the ugly potential buyer says, "Nevertheless, I still want to see." Hifshita shisha halukim. So the captor started taking off six of the layers. Ushvi karaita, when it came to the seventh layer, she herself ripped it, v'nispalsha ba'efer, and she wallowed and was rolling around in the dust. Omra lefanav, she says, "Ribono shelolam, im oleinu lechaste, even if you don't have rachmanos on us Jews, al kedushas shimcha gibor lama leisachus, why do you not have rachmanos on the kedusha of your mighty name? That's a tremendous chil Hashem. The goyim think that you have no power to save us." Chaser shalom. V'aleh koinin yumia, Yumia again expresses that in a pasuk, but this is not a pasuk from Eicha, unlike the ones we've been bringing until now. This is a pasuk from Sefer Yumia. Bas Ami, daughter of my people, chigri sack, gird yourself with sackcloth, v'ispalshi ba'efer, and wallow in the ashes, where ashes can also mean efer, can also mean dust. Evil yachid asiloch, make for yourself a mourning like you would for a single, for an only child. An only child passes away, of course, there's intense mourning, so mourn as bitterly as you would for that. Mispad tamrurim, a bitter hesped, kipisa and yavei ashoded aleinu, because all of a sudden the robber will come against us. So the Gemara points out, alayich lenema. Now the whole rest of the pasuk has been in third person, saying that you should be doing this. Now all of a sudden it's aleinu in plural. So alech alayich lenema, ela aleinu kavyochol alive alayich boshoded. Hashem is saying kavyochol, the enemy has come against me and against you. Meaning, in other words, exactly that. Hashem is acknowledging through the Navi that yes, it's true. Hashem is suffering with all of the suffering that's happening to the Jewish people as well. And Maharsha points out that Evo Yochid, by the way, also means, you know, we have the famous expression, Tzoras Rabim Chatzi Nechama, when more people share the same trouble, then it's got half a comfort for them. But here the Pasuk is saying, consider it like you, as if like you're the only one in this situation, and therefore how bitterly you'd feel about it. And that's how the Golos should feel. Amar of Yehuda Amar Rav, my dichtiv, what does it mean a pasuk in Micha, the oshku gever uvesev ish v'nachalase, they rob or wrong a man and his household and a person and his nach. So in other words, we're going to tell a story now that triggered the Churban, where one yid took advantage of another one and then cheated him out of his wife and out of his nechassim in a very underhanded way, and that was a cause of the churban. It happened once a certain man had put his eyes on his master's wife. She was beautiful, and he started having a type for her. This one who had this taiva was an apprentice to a carpenter. So his master means, in other words, the carpenter who was teaching him, the more expert carpenter who was teaching him the trade. One time this master carpenter needed to borrow money. So the student says, send your wife to me and I'll lend her the money. So the master didn't suspect anything. He sent his wife to him. Ben Yehoyada, I think it is, talks about how did it not occur to him that he might be doing it for Znus, and he explains various ways how the Talmud made it sound very plausible that he wants to after her and not him. It'll be less embarrassing for you and so forth. Anyway, Shoha Ima Shloisha Yomim, the student stayed with her for 3 days. So he kept her in his house for 3 days. Were they mizana during that time? We'll talk about soon. Eventually, the master comes early to the Talmud's house. Omaloi says, "Ishti sheshigatu lo chechani, when my wife that I sent her to you, where is she already? It's 3 days." Omaloi ani patatia la alder. So the student falsely says, I sent her away right away. But I heard that some young boys abused her and abused her on the way. So in other words, she was mizana. Then Yoyada points out, she says the word tinoikus, in other words, as if to imply they're not strong men where you could argue that maybe, look, you know, she was an onus and she can't really help it. They were children, so obviously they wouldn't have had the power to overpower her. She must have voluntarily gone along with it. So the teacher says, what should I do? So the student says, if you want to listen to my advice, divorce her. The teacher says, her ksuba is a large amount of money. I can't afford it. So the student says, I'll lend you the money. And you pay her ksuba. So sure enough, the teacher went and divorced her. And the student married her, which is what he was trying to do all along. Then eventually the time came to pay back the loan, and the teacher didn't have what to pay. Then the student says, come and work for me, and you'll pay off your debt that way. So now the student and his new wife, who used to be the teacher's wife, are sitting and eating and drinking. And the teacher, the former husband of this woman, is standing there and serving them drinks. Tears were falling from his eyes and landing in their cups. So this is what the pasuk means. In other words, that he robbed and wronged the man and his house, and his heritage that he did such an underhanded trick to force the guy into servitude in a way like that. At that time, the Gzar Din, that there's going to be a Churban and there's going to be a Golos, was sealed on the Jewish people, because, of course, you know, obviously we have to be talking about that they did this and people knew about it and they weren't Moicha. Others say because of two wicks in one candle, which is a nice way of saying that there was actual Znus, that she was an HSH. So Marashah explains, in other words, the Arab, that when she was by him for 3 days, were they mezana or not? The first version is saying that they were not mezana during that time. So therefore, what's considered wrong is just there was no znus over here. Everything on the face of it was done in accordance with halacha, but nevertheless, it was a very underhanded thing to do. According to the second version, there was actual znus. He was actually mezana with her as an HSH during those 3 days. Either way, we're saying that the gzar din was issued against everybody because of that, because they knew about it and they weren't moichet. So that ends the agadah about the churban. Now getting back to matters of halacha, the Mishnah had said lokach min ha-sikrikun chula. We said so. The Mishnah had mentioned this concept of a sikrikun, a goy who threatens to kill a yid, and the yid buys his life by giving the goy his land. And then we talk about what happens if another yid buys from that sikrikun. So we had in the Mishnah three different stages of the takana. The first stage was that you have to first arrange with the original yid to buy it from him. And if not, if you first arrange it with the sikrikun, then it's not a valid sale. The second stage was that we said that you could buy it from the sikrikun, but you have to give the owner a quarter of the value, which we're going to talk about that in the Gemara tomorrow on Daf Nuntes Ves Hashem. And then there was a Rebbe, and then Rebbe made the third stage of it, that as long as, but then in that second stage, if the original owner is able to buy it, then he has first rights. And then the third stage was that Rebbe said, once it's 12 months from the Sikrikun's hand, and nobody has bought it from him yet, then any yid is allowed to buy it from him, and he doesn't have to give first rights to the original owner. Anyway, so the Gemara says, lokach min ha-sikrikun chula. So we said that if a person buys from the sikrikun and then from the balabas, then no good, because then the balabas, so in the Mishnah, we mentioned two reasons. The balabas might only be doing it out of fear, because he's afraid if he doesn't ratify what the sikrikun already did, selling the land to the other guy, then the sikrikun will come back and kill him. And the other reason is he may think, you know what, as long as the sikrikun holds on to the land, I have no recourse to get it back from him. Once another yid buys it, then I'll be able to take him to Beis Din and get it back. So therefore, he never really gave up hope of getting back the land. So the Gemara says, Amar Rav, lo shonu elo do amar leich chazak o kni. This would only apply if the original owner says to the one who bought it from the sikrikun. So in other words, so you have the field belonged to Reuven, a sikrikun took it from him. Now Shimon is coming to buy the land. He went and paid the sikrikun for it. Now he's coming to check with Reuven. And Reuven just tells him, Leich chazak ukni, go ahead, do a chazak on it, and you'll acquire the field that way. So he didn't actually do anything. He just said to go and do chazakah. So therefore we could say that he's saying, Hasheni noyachli, I'd rather deal with the second one because he's easier to deal with. Shimon, I can take the based in, the sikrikun, I'm not going to be able to. So therefore, in other words, we say that, so therefore he didn't actually mean to give up hope of getting back the field, and therefore Shimon is in fact obligated to return it to him, says Rav. Aval, the shtar, but if Reuven actually wrote out a shtar for him to acquire it, kona, then he would in fact be koine it that way, because once he already did an action to write out a shtar, then already we can say he definitely meant to give it to him. So in other words, when he says leich chazak o kni, it would mean that he's thinking Hasheni noyachli, I'd rather deal with the second one in Beis Din, but there'd be no reason, Rav says, for him to write a shtar in order to do that, and therefore we have every right to assume that he actually means to sell it permanently. Shmuel says no, even with a shtar, the second person is not fully acquiring it, having first bought it from the sikrikun, unless the original owner writes achrayus in the shtar, meaning he says, if they take away the field from you in payment of a debt of mine or something, then I will reimburse you. At that point, then we say for sure he meant to sell it. For sure he meant to sell it irrevocably. Tosfos points out that the underlying machloikas Rav and Shmuel may be on the question of achrayus tos soifer. In general, when you sell a field, when you sell real estate, usually there's a clause in it called achrayus, exactly that, that if the field gets taken away for any reason, for example, because of money that I owe somebody else or whatever, then I will reimburse you. And the Gemara discusses elsewhere, if that wasn't written in a shtar, is it still valid or not? Do we say it's considered as though it was written and it's just a mistake on the sofer's part, or do we not say that? So Rab holds Achrayus Lav Tos Sofer Hu. So therefore, or the other way around, Shmuel holds Achrayus Lav Tos Sofer. Rab holds Achrayus Tos Sofer. So therefore, once a shtar is written, Rab says automatically there is Achrayus involved. Whereas Shmuel says, no, Achrayus has to actually be written in the shtar. So even a shtar was written, but there's no Achrayus, it's not strong enough to mean that it was an actual sale, unless there's Achrayus involved. Then that shows that the original owner for sure gave up hope of ever getting back this land. So the Gemara continues, Tanya Kavasei de Shmuel, we learn a Braisa like the way Shmuel explains it. There are Rishonim who instead have the Girsa Mesvi that the Gemara is going to bring this as a question on Rab. Reb Shimon Alaza Omer, Lokach Mina Isha. Now we had in the Mishnah, we drew a parallel between the case of the Sikrikun and the case of a husband who's selling the wife's Nichsim Alug. So again, we have the same kind of thing. It could be Nichsim Alug, it could be Rashi said on the Mishnah, actually land that was supposed to be reserved for her to collect her ksuba from, whatever. Anyway, the point is, same idea. If you first buy from the husband and then you go check with the wife, then just because she said, go ahead and buy it, then that doesn't mean that she intends to agree to the sale, because she can say, Nachas Ruach HaSisi LeBaili, I just want to please my husband. Once he said, I want to sell it, then fine, I'll go along with it because of Shalom Bias, but I'm not actually giving up my rights to it. So we learn in a Braisa, like what Shmuel says, Reb Shimon Elazar Omer, Lokach Mina Isha, if a person bought this field first from the wife, and then he bought from the husband, then it's a valid sale because there's no reason she didn't have to first agree to it. But if he bought first from the husband and then from the wife, then the sale is bottled, unless the wife writes Achrayus into the shtar. So we see, like Shmuel says, that the key thing is whether Achrayus is written. So once that applies to that, then it also applies to Sikrikun because the logic is the same. So the Gemara says, "Name a tevit yuv to the Rab." Well, does that mean that the Braisa actually contradicts Rab? And the answer is, "Amalach Rab, my Achrayus nami shtar." No, the word Achrayus doesn't mean the actual words in the shtar that say Achrayus. It just means a shtar is called Achrayus for this purpose. Once a shtar is written, where there it's Achrayus in the sense that Rashi says she's saying, "Now I'm giving up my rights. I'm not going to come after you and say, but I was supposed to collect my ksuba from this field, and therefore you have to give it back." And again, according to Tosfos and Amud Aleph, what it means is Rab is saying once a shtar is written, automatically Achrayus is included in it. The Gemara continues, Tana Rabbanan, Lokach min asik rikun v'ochla shalosh shanim b'fnei baylim. What happens, a yid buys the field from Sikrikun and he eats the produce of it for 3 years, b'fnei baylim, with the knowledge of the owner. So at that point, 3 years already he has chazaka. And then he went and sold it to somebody else. The owner cannot claim anything from the second buyer. So even, in other words, we said in the Mishnah that the second and third stages of the takana of Sikrikun is that you have to pay the bailim a revia, one quarter. But in this case, when the first buyer from the Sikrikun already had Shnei Chazaka, then therefore we can assume that at that point he already paid the owner his portion, because otherwise during those 3 years the owner should have protested and said that you haven't yet paid the revia. In other words, Rashi says basically the first buyer has a migri. At this point, after 3 years, he has every right to say, you know what, I paid you the revia and fully bought it from you in a proper way, and therefore the owner can't now go to the original owner can't now go to the second buyer and demand his cut. So we want to ask, hey, Chidomi, well, what's the scenario? If the second lokeach is saying I bought it, saying that I is claiming that the first one that I bought it from you. So in other words, we have Reuven, the original owner of the field. We have Shimon, and then we have the Sikrikun. Then we have Shimon, the second. Then we have Shimon, the first buyer, and then we have Levi, the second buyer, who bought it from Shimon. If Levi is saying Shimon bought it directly from you, Afilu Rishonami, then even the first one could already claim after 3 years that he paid them their quarter. And if Levi is not arguing that, then even the second one shouldn't be potter. We should make him pay the revia. What is the scenario over here where we're saying on the face of it that the first one can't make this claim, but the second one can. So Rav Sheshet says, we are talking about this. Levi is not making any such claim. Levi is not saying that Shimon did the right thing and paid you the Raviyah. But to Goinzeh, Toyin and Leyodish, this would be the kind of thing after Shimon has already had Chazakah for 3 years. In that kind of case, Toyin and Leyodish, Beis Din will make a claim on behalf of, had it been an heir. So in other words, if Shimon had passed away and left the field to his children, Beis Din would argue on behalf of those children that Shimon must have paid the Raviyah, and therefore they shouldn't have to, because it's a reasonable claim, because once he had 3 years Chazakah. And similarly, Toyin and Lekeach, and similarly, Beis Din will argue on behalf of the Lekeach, on behalf of Levi, that Shimon had paid his Raviyah, and therefore that Levi is not on the hook for anything. Rashi adds, now there is a Gemara, there is a, in Bava Basra, you have an opinion that says, no, you don't toyin l'yorish al l'keach, but he agrees, because in general, when a person buys from a sikrikon, he knows that he's going to have to pay the revia, and he's not going to stamp pay out money unless he first arranges that, so that it'll be a valid sale. So therefore, as far as Shimon, as far as the first buyer, e toyin ein, if he claims that he bought it validly and paid the revia, then good, because after all, he had the chazaka of 3 years. But if he doesn't claim that, we don't claim it on his behalf, only when it comes to the lekeach, to Levi, would Beis Din make such a claim on his behalf. Tosfos also adds the point that in this case over here, you would think that maybe the owner has a point, and you could say, I wasn't moicha during all these years because I was afraid of the sikrikun. Nevertheless, we say it's not so. So the Gemara continues, Tanan Abanan, habom machmas choy v'machmas anporus. When a goy comes and takes a field from a Jew and forces a Jew to give him his field because he owes him money. So till now, we're talking about sikrikun, where the goy is just, he's a tough guy and he's threatening to kill the yid. And so the yid buys his life with his field. Now we're talking about the goy is actually owed money by the yid, or umachmas anporus, or because of anporus, which would be some kind of thing where he forces him to give him the field, but he's not able to kill him, but he's able to harass him and to steal the field from him. So then, the din of sikrikun does not apply to such a field. So then, whoever bought the field from this person has to give it back to the owner. It's machlokas Rashi and Tosfos, Rashi over here, Tosfos elsewhere, whether the original owner has to reimburse him or not. Rashi says he doesn't even have to reimburse him. Tosfos elsewhere says that he does. Now, in order for the din of anporus to kick in, it has to have stayed 12 months in the hand of the goy. So the Gemara asks, what do you mean? Ba'amat einba mishum sikrikun. What do you mean? You just said there's no din of sikrikun. So what do you need 12 months for? The answer is, hachikama, sikrikun atzma tzricha shetisha yud beis chodesh. It means the sikrikun itself, the actual case of our Mishnah of sikrikun, in order for another person to be able to buy it, would need to stay 12 months in the sikrikun's hands. If not, then, like we said in the Mishnah, then the owner has the right to, once somebody else buys it from the sikrikun, to get it back from him. After 12 months, as we said in the Mishnah, then we say at that point he's already given up hope of getting it back. So the Gemara continues, Amar Rav Yosef, Naktinan, we have the Kabbalah, Ein Anporus B'Bavel. There's no Anporus, there's none of this kind of thing, of a goy forcing a yid to give him his land, a Stam Gezel, in Bavel. So therefore, in other words, so that would mean that if a yid comes in Bavel and says that a goy did that, he stole my field, we wouldn't believe him. So the Gemara says, Barkachlin and De'ika, the fact is there are such cases in Bavel. And the answer is, Ela Ika, Ela Ema, Ein Din Anporus B'Bavel. What we mean is the din of Anporus does not apply. So if a goy does steal a field from a yid in Bavel, and then another yid buys it from him, then we don't have the din of Anporus that we just said before, that the second one has to return it to the first one. My timer, why is that? Kibben de'ika be'davar. because in Bavel there are because in Bavel there are authorities. Beit Davar literally means the place where they receive mail. That's in modern Hebrew. You have the word Doar, it means mail, but basically it means because there in those times the mail in those times the post office was the local Goyish ruler's house, basically. So you have a Beit Davar, you have an official government agency over there, and the Yid could have gone as soon as this Goy takes over his field. He could have gone there to complain. But like also cover, he didn't go to complain there and open a case against the Goy. Ema acholi achil, we have good reason to think that he was moichel and he's not planning to get the field back. So therefore, the din of Anporus doesn't apply, and we will say that the second Yid is allowed to keep the field, and that's that. So the Gemara tells one more case in this connection. Gido Bar Rilai, that was the guy's name. We had him earlier on Daflam and Dalid. Kabel Arab Taskim Ibnei Boga. He bought from the people of a certain valley the right to have Paris of land. This was land that had been abandoned by so Rashi explains the way it used to work is that in every valley where there were a lot of fields, the deal is the valley collectively, all the farmers who have fields in that valley pay X amount in taxes every year to the king. And so then each person gives a proportional amount depending on how much land he owns. So now one person who owned one of those fields was out of town. So now what's going to happen is the tax collectors still want the full amount. So what's going to happen as far as his share? So in this case, the other farmers who didn't want to have to pay this guy's share, they gave this giddle that he should eat, that he should pay the taxes on behalf of that absent owner, and he'll be able to get the pay rest of that field for the next few years in return for that until the owner returns. So Gidol went and prepaid the taxes for the next 3 years on the field. So that should mean, so now if the guy doesn't come back anytime during those 3 years, then Gidol will have 3 years of produce from that field that he can eat. Eventually the original owner, the one who had left town without arranging for his taxes, came back and he found that Gidol was in possession of the field. So they told him, so they told Gidol, Shata Kamaisa, do you have it, Achlat? The first year, you already paid the taxes. So, okay, you already ate the produce of then. Hashta, nan yavinan, nan achlinan. But now, we'll pay the taxes for the rest of the years and we'll get the produce. You shouldn't have the right to continue eating the produce because you prepaid the taxes for the 3 years. Also, Kamei, did a papa. So they came to the papa for a din turtle. Sovrul amichdav le tirpa abnei boga. So Rapapa thought that Gidol has the right of the argument over here, and they should write out a tirpa, they should write a shtar, that he's entitled to seize property from the Bnei Boga, from the farmer. As Tosfos says, specifically it means this particular farmer, where this particular landowner, owner, where Gidol had temporarily taken over his land. So in other words, Rapapa thought to say that Gidol has a valid point. He prepaid the taxes, therefore he's entitled to the produce of the land for the full 3 years. If you're going to pask him like that, then in effect, you're making it like a sick record. After all, in the Mishnah, it says that you do acquire the field, but you pay the original owner of the fact, you pay the revia, because as the Gemara is going to say further, that the goy sells it at a discount, and therefore you have to pay the original owner. So the same way, in other words, the fact is, the king doesn't actually own the land per se. His right to the land is strictly because of the taxes. So what do you mean? So you're saying that you want the owner to reimburse Gidol for the 2 years of taxes that he paid, and if not, then Gidol will have the right to take away property from him in payment of that. That's in effect like a sicurikum kind of thing. He shouldn't have prepaid. This is like the expression we had in Ksubas. He put his money on the horn of a deer. In other words, he lost it. It's his problem that he prepaid for 3 years like that. He shouldn't have done that. And therefore, this farmer is not responsible to pay him back for anything. The farmer can take back over his field and continue paying the taxes on his own to the king. And Gidol has forfeited 2 years worth of taxes that he prepaid on it. Okay, so we'll continue tomorrow, Be'ez Hashem, with more about this din of Sikrikan.